from the nation's capital, for National Public Radio, this is Josh Darsa speaking to you from the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In a moment, the fourth program of the new fall series of National Town Meetings will be getting underway. The topic of this National Town Meeting, Beyond Personalities, What Kind of Leadership Does America Need? The principal speakers will be Senator James Pearson, Republican of Kansas, I.F. Stone, publisher and critic, and Kevin Phillips, author and columnist. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These National Town Meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished figures from various fields, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the most important subjects of the day. And now, the moderator of this National Town Meeting, Linda Matthews of the Los Angeles Times.
Welcome to National Town Meeting. Today, the topic for discussion is, what kind of leadership does America need? There's no doubt that we Americans expect too much of our leaders, particularly our president. We want him or her to be hardworking, but not a dull, humorless drone. He must have principles, but of course he shouldn't be so stubborn that he's incapable of compromising. We would hope for a little warmth and charisma, but spare us, please, from all those fools who go around slapping backs and kissing babies. Who can possibly satisfy all these exacting and contradictory standards? Who can be all things to all people? In two words, Abraham Lincoln, or so suggests a columnist from the Christian Science Monitor. On the assumption that no 20th century Abraham Lincoln will emerge soon to rescue us from our problems, our panel today will talk about next best alternatives, what kind of leadership we need, and what kind we can expect. Only 10 years ago, our first panelist was fresh out of Harvard Law School and, like hundreds of young men, laboring on Capitol Hill as a lowly congressional aide. Today, Kevin Phillips is one of the country's leading conservative commentators with a publishing empire of his own. He writes a widely syndicated newspaper column, helps operate a polling company, contributes to TV Guide, and regularly produces closely reasoned analysis of American political trends, complete with historical and literary allusions. His latest book is Mediocracy, American Parties and Politics in the Communications Age. Although he did political research for Richard Nixon in 1968 and later worked as a special assistant in the Justice Department, Mr. Phillips is no knee-jerk Republican. In his typically iconoclastic fashion, Mr. Phillips has suggested publicly that President Ford retire in 1976 because he is so out of touch with the American people. According to Mr. Phillips, the Republican Party... Mr. Phillips believes the Republican Party itself is threatened with destruction because it remains oriented to the rich, genteel, Ivy League Eastern establishment and ignores the populist yearnings of Southern and Western Republicans. Let's hear from Mr. Phillips.
As you might guess from that, my suggestions relating to the problems of American leadership are very substantially structural, relating to the institutions that we have, the institutions that aren't performing terribly well. So let me begin by saying that the general second-rate nature of our elected politicians works to obscure the even greater problem of a second-rate structure of government. There is nothing America needs more than a massive, even revolutionary overhaul of existing governmental structures and political processes. It ought to be a major bicentennial project. First, we need to modify the vaunted separation of powers between Congress and the executive branch. This doctrine was a misconception 200 years ago when the framers of the Constitution embraced it. And recently, it has led to policymaking paralysis and to institutionalization and competition in perquisites that has now produced an imperial Congress to go with the imperial presidency. Let us move further in the direction of responsive and even parliamentary government towards party responsibility, party debate, and cohesion between the executive and legislative branches. Second, we ought to curb the power of the judicial branch. Federal judges are becoming petty sociological dictators without parallel anywhere in the Western democracies. Third, we need major electoral process reforms. Automatic national voter registration, for one. Then we should scrap the new federal campaign finance system, which is nothing but a protection act for incumbents and the two existing major parties. Also, national primaries should be enacted. The Electoral College should be abandoned. All of these changes would take away the artificial props of the two-party system, increase voter participation, and make public opinion count again. If we open up the system in this fashion, then perhaps we'll begin to get some leadership again.
Long before anyone had ever heard of Woodward and Bernstein, our next panelist had earned a reputation as perhaps the foremost investigative reporter of his era. In the style of a Revolutionary War pamphleteer, I.F. Stone, for 19 years, published his own very personal and very opinionated newsletter called, appropriately enough, I.F. Stone's Weekly. The Weekly was strictly a one-man operation. Mr. Stone was editor, publisher, reporter, and researcher rolled into one. Reporters for other publications attended press conferences and rewrote press releases. Mr. Stone pored over the congressional record, studied the federal budget, and sifted through the evidence like an attorney preparing for trial. With disconcerting frequency, Mr. Stone was the one who got the real story first. He was the first, for example, to question the genuineness of the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident, which precipitated the American air war against North Vietnam and led to the commitment of 500,000 American soldiers to Southeast Asia. Subsequent books and congressional investigations confirmed Mr. Stone's suspicions. The Weekly closed shop in 1971, but Mr. Stone's brand of prophecy and polemic lives on. He has contributed frequently to the New York Review of Books, lectured widely, and been the subject of an acclaimed documentary film. Mr. Stone?
The first thing we need is a leadership not picked by Richard Nixon to guarantee him a blanket pardon. And the second thing we need is a leadership that will stay put. Even a poor newspaper man who works 7 days a week can't keep up with all the complicated issues and events in the Capitol. And it's a very strange spectacle to have the president, at a time of such difficult issues and crises, running around the country shaking hands. You know, there are two dangers, not one, that face the president on these trips. There are two kinds of mental illness, not one, that represent a threat to him personally and to the office. One, of course, is paranoia, the danger that some silly, sick fool, anxious for instant notoriety, will take a shot at him. But the other, the subtler, and the more continuous danger is megalomania, the occupational disease of presidents, as of all rulers in all societies in all times. It takes a Lincoln to be in that office and stay humble. And all those smiling faces and cheering crowds do for the president is to give him a swelled head and a great ego trip. And Mr. Ford has said he wants to keep in touch with the people, but that kind of swift trip around the country merely guarantees that he'll be taken further and further away from reality into a dream world in which Gerald Ford is again the fullback football star and everybody's cheering him, and it has nothing whatsoever to do. He would do better. It's a tough job to take off his shoes, put his feet on the desk, and read the morning paper. But if he wants to go beyond that, He could call people in quietly of different points of view and talk with them, because the problems before the country are very complicated and none of us know the answers. And number three, and at the expense of not being invited again on this wonderful program, I must say we need a president who does not think that the Gettysburg Address recommended government of the people by the politicians for the oil companies. A president who is constantly advising the poor to be more austere, who is allowing the greatest city and the greatest country in the world to drift toward bankruptcy, the most disastrous domino effect this country will ever undergo, it'll shake the world as well as our own markets, this man takes out of his hat, via that poor struggling fellow, Nelson Rockefeller, that poor boy, you know, that worked his way up here, Horatio Alger fashion. And they have a wonderful plan to give $100 billion, not to New York, not to education, not to sewers, not to public transportation, but to those poor, struggling oil companies who, as you all know, are having such a hard time hiding their profits from the public. And finally, and above all, we need a leadership with imagination and compassion. Our country is very deeply divided, and we need a leadership with understanding that can unite and heal old wounds and inspire and restore, especially to the youth on whom the future depends, a sense of pride in the country and a sense of purpose. And in my lifetime, I have seen one president like that, and we need again another type of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Our third panelist is Senator James B. Pearson, a Kansas Republican who has served almost 14 years in the United States Senate. The last time he stood for re-election, he won a whopping 71% of the vote. He is the ranking Republican on the Senate Commerce Committee and also sits on the Foreign Relations Committee and the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. Republicans completely dominate Kansas politics, and Senator Pearson's roots run deep into his party. He served, for example, as state party chairman in Kansas before entering the Senate. But despite his commitment to Republican candidates and causes, the senator has never been afraid to break with party leadership and strike out on his own. He voted against the Nixon administration on several key issues, including the anti-ballistic missile, the Haynesworth nomination to the Supreme Court, and Vietnam withdrawal. Senator Pearson.
Mr. Phillips, Mr. Stone. Ladies and gentlemen, before I came out here, the moderator said that I was to attempt to take the middle ground between the right and the left. I am squeezed and crushed not so much by my panelists' philosophies, but by their wit and wisdom. Considering the number and complexity of the problems facing us, the reflex answer to the question posed today is to assert that we need strong and able leaders. But whether it be in national politics or the local garden club, there can be strong and powerful leaders only if there are willing and dedicated followers. There are not many followers in this country today. We are without heroes of any sort. But because we are basically a strong and resilient nation, we are getting by in some fashion, at least for now, despite this anti-leadership mood. We might even speculate that a George Washington today would be spurned as too patrician, Jefferson would be rejected as too intellectual and idealistic, Lincoln because he's too homespun, Teddy Roosevelt because he was too nationalistic, and FDR, of course, would be part of the establishment. And Congress today is leaderless, not because there is no one capable of leadership, but because too many senators and congressmen don't want to be led. Their own ambitions and programs hold higher priorities. People everywhere have felt that government, particularly here in Washington, was remote and unresponsive. And partly as a result of this feeling, there has been a proliferation of interest groups, which makes decisive leadership and action more difficult. Increasingly, it seems to me that the American public expresses itself through organizations that have a narrow point of view, whether it be to protect an economic interest or promote a political philosophy. Thus, every significant policy proposal must run the gauntlet of the common causes, the Sierra Clubs, the Chamber of Commerce, the retired citizens, the National Association of Truck Stop Operators, and the list goes on and on. Although this is healthy in the sense and more points of view are expressed, it has the effect of forcing policymakers too often to lose the general interest while seeking to accommodate the multiplicity of special interests. Another powerful factor at work here, it seems to me, is that in this post-Vietnam and post-Watergate era, the news media and the public is focusing more on how things are done in politics and government than on what is done. This excessive concentration on process rather than performance has a crippling effect upon leadership. The excessive demand for total correctness in procedures and form may well be more conducive to mediocrity than to greatness of achievement. Given all of these factors, the leaders who are most likely to survive are those who are particularly skilled in appealing to the greatest number of special interest groups and who have the capacity to identify with the transitory mood of the public at large. But the leader who is successful in this process necessarily projects the very type of image the public condemns, and that is that he has no long-range view of what is good and right for the country and is simply a broker for various groups. What kind of leadership do we need? All the old cliches about honesty and openness and candidness and ethical correctness come to mind, but too often this is translated into such things as public disclosure of personal finances and whether or not a congressman has gone on a junket. Rather, these terms should, I suggest, apply to the manner in which the leader addresses his constituents. We need more leaders to talk straight and who do not promise more than they or the government can perform or deliver. We need leaders who are candid enough to admit that they don't have a personal solution to every problem that their constituents bring to their attention. Leaders are by definition ambitious. But in a certain sense, it can be argued that we need more leaders who have a more limited sense of ambition. The Congress would not be so leaderless today or in such a state of disarray if there were not so many individual members consumed by the ambition of attracting a national audience in order to launch a campaign for the presidency. In short, we need more senators whose greatest ambition is simply to be a good senator, more governors who want to be good governors, more mayors who want to be good mayors.
Now it's your turn to question our speakers. There are floor microphones in the far right and left aisles. Please, before you state your question, could you tell us your name and indicate to whom you are addressing the question? I think we have a question down here on the right.
My name is Josh Miller, and I'm from Santa Cruz, California, and I want to address this to I.F. Stone. But I would first like to say that any town meeting which doesn't allow citizens to speak with each other and to make statements to each other is a total farce. My question is this. How could we possibly have great leadership in a democratic country when our citizens have no control of the decision-making process in their communities and in their workplace, and when all power is held in Washington and the corporations? Isn't it true that the problem is that we always think of leadership instead of looking to ourselves as citizens and asking what politics we can make in this country?
Well, there are a couple questions there. Mr. Stone, you want to attack those?
Just sit here.
I think you can sit here.
The people of this country can have whatever they want if they want it and speak up. And they don't get what they want because they rarely speak up. But congressmen and state legislators are very sensitive to public opinion. It's a mistake to address the problem in such sweeping global terms. When the people are silent, then special interests have the field to themselves. But when they take the trouble to get up on their hind legs and yell, they get what they want. It's still a free country, and it's up to the people of this country.
Down here to my left.
Yes. Carlos Van Leer with today's story, New York Times, of the new Yale School to train government leaders better and business leaders. And this Hubert Humphrey 1970 quotation, when you're deeply involved in public life, you have some blinders on, close quote. My question to the panel, how can Yale train government leaders so they don't wear blinders and stumble blindly from one disaster like Vietnam into another?
Senator Pearson, do you want to try that one?
Well, I'll take off my blinders and attempt to. I think once people in public life today, under a literal Niagara of problems and programs, can take off the blinders first if they first understand, and maybe this is something that you can indoctrinate in them, understand that you can't do everything all the time for everyone, and I don't mean that in a philosophical way. You have to pick and choose as to what sort of commitments you want to make to what kind of issues, and then do the very best you can in that particular field. I think one of the greatest problems and how we get so confused and how we adopt those blinders is a propensity of so many of my brothers and myself to be out here in the Congress taking all these bills in to try to do too much too soon and too frequently.
Thank you. We have a question on a card for Mr. Phillips. Someone in our audience wants to know how you would dispose of our current two-party system and adopt a parliamentary system. Is that really possible?
Well, I wouldn't dispose entirely. I think you have to modify and go at this in an evolutionary process. But I think there are a number of things that can be done that would move in this direction that would be beneficial. For example, back in the 19th century, the Congress several times passed resolutions inviting members of the President's cabinet to come and sit on the floor of the House or the Senate and take part in debates relating to their field of specialty, their departmental jurisdiction. There is nothing stopping the President of the United States from forming a cabinet to include people who are senators and congressmen. Now, they can't be appointed as Secretary of Defense or Secretary of Labor because they would then hold office under the United States. But they can be a member of the cabinet without portfolio, in essence, because that would not involve a federal office, and the cabinet itself has no recognition in the Constitution. So I think it would be possible to move in that direction. You would greatly improve the quality and the tenacity of debate. It wouldn't be possible for the administration's people to duck on major issues, but it also wouldn't be possible for what I consider to be the jokish Democratic leadership of the Congress to avoid showing that they too have no position or a semi-position on all these issues. It would force them to come to grips. That's point one. Secondly, it would begin to tie together the parties in the Congress and in the executive branch, which right now you have very different coalitions, in essence. The South in 1972 voted strongly Republican for president and substantially Democratic for Congress. It's just part of the ticket-splitting system, which has given us a two-tier electorate and has prevented the parties from developing a cohesion and a unity based on substantially similar constituencies in the executive and legislative branch. I think all of this tends to paralyze policymaking. And within the confines of what I described in terms of what presidents can do and what Congress can do, I think that would be a very effective opening step.
Yeah, Mr. Stone, did you want to add something?
I'd like to add that the problem is not to reform the cabinet system, but to restore it. What the Nixon administration did was to destroy the cabinet system in large part by creating a state within a state inside the White House protected by executive privilege. So the decisions were made by a huge White House staff covered by, but protected by executive privilege and abuse of executive privilege from questioning by the Congress. And that trend has continued under Mr. Ford. He has a huge White House staff, and the cabinet system was pretty responsive. But the Nixon system of creating a state within a state and a miniature cabinet inside the White House, not subject to interrogation, confirmation, and discussion, that's the very serious new development government that we ought to try and undo.
Thank you. We have several questions here on the left.
My name is Vincent Curtin. I'm a teacher at Georgetown Prep School here in Washington. And this question is addressed to Mr. Phillips. What specifically can we do before the next election to open the presidential campaign to real public opinion?
Mr. Stone, did you hear that question?
I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult before the next campaign unless you get a breakdown of the two-party system. Otherwise, I think you're likely to see a situation where the Republican Party will nominate Jerry Ford and the Democratic Party will reach back into the old bag and come up with that 18-year veteran of every primary in the country, Hubert Humphrey. And this is the sort of thing, of course, that's contributed to the steady downflow of public participation in the political process over the last 10 years. So I would hope that out of the spring holocaust, so to speak, we get a sufficiency of new parties and new independent candidacies to generate a real public feeling that the fullness of the spectrum is covered. Secondly, I think instead of piecemeal postcard registration, which lends itself to abuse by pressure groups, we ought to have what Canada, Britain, and many other English-speaking countries, as well as continental European countries, have, which is automatic voter registration. And bring all these people who claim to be alienated into the process, and let's see what direction their alienation takes when they get a chance to vote.
Thank you. Next.
My name is William Thomas, and I teach English at Hood College in Frederick, Maryland. I'd like to direct a question to Mr. Stone. In your opening remarks, you
Can you be a little louder, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is William Thomas. I teach English at Hood College in Frederick, Maryland, and I'd like to address a question to Mr. Stone. In your opening remarks, you suggested that President Ford made secret arrangements to pardon President Nixon, and I was wondering if you could tell us what those arrangements were.
I didn't say the secret arrangements had been made. I can't prove secret arrangements, and I have no evidence of it. I just said he was picked by Nixon as the man Nixon felt was most likely to give him the pardon he wanted and needed and got.
Jeffrey Peters.
That's quite a microphone you got here. My name is Jeffrey Peters, and I'd like to address these questions to Mr. Stone and Mr. Phillips. Mr. Stone mentioned that today we have government for the oil companies. Two questions. First, how would you improve the performance of our business sector? And specifically, do you favor a federal chartering of the 1,000 largest corporations, including requirements for corporate democracy, corporate disclosure, and stricter enforcement of antitrust laws?
Okay, let's get answers to that question before we go on.
That's a lot of questions in one bag right there. I don't think that federal chartering of corporations is any great panacea. It was up in the 1890s and 1900. I'm not against it, but it isn't going to change things. You can't talk of the whole business system as one big thing. Parts of it have free enterprise and parts of it don't. As far as the oil companies are concerned, that's a special problem because a monopoly is so strong. I favor doing something that the antitrust laws were intended to do a long time ago, and that is break up the crude oil business from the refining and the transportation. And if we can't do it that way, then I favor the government taking over the oil business, because where energy is so terribly important, and its pricing and control have been marked by a half century of outstanding abuses, then I think the only sensible remedy is public ownership.
Did you have anything to add?
Yes, let me comment on this. I think that the point is in order here regarding the threat to the economy as solely coming from corporations and from business. Unless I very much miss my guess, the organizations that are paralyzing America's cities are not Caterpillar Tractor and the White Motor Company. They're labor unions. And if we're going to have the application of reform and participatory democracy and the antitrust laws, we ought to have them applied to the runaway power of organized labor as well as the runaway power of corporations.
Let's try a question on the right here.
Mark Nagel, Atlanta, Georgia. I'd like to ask Mr. Phillips a question. What effect do you think abolishing the Electoral College is going to have on the two-party system?
I think abolishing the Electoral College would in the long term facilitate the development of third and fourth and fifth parties that would more fully articulate a cross spectrum of opinion. The Electoral College tends to, in its the final hours of a presidential campaign, to wash away minority parties because of a minimal prospect that a vote cast for them will be effective. And I think that had the two major parties performed more effectively, I would not be in favor of diminishing their position, but they haven't, so I am, and I think the Electoral College is a step, getting rid of it is a step towards reducing the two-party system.
We have a young man down here on the left.
My name is Michael Rosides, and I'd like to ask Senator Pearson, how do you feel about President Ford traveling all over the country? Do you feel that's good?
Michael, I don't think you can have a responsive presidency if you're going to have a president that goes to the extreme of locking himself up in the Oval Office and never even getting out to see the country and to see the people. But I at the same time, I think this idea that you're having a meaningful dialogue when you go up and down a fence is pretty ridiculous. Yeah. Let me say that I think people and institutions ought to change with changing times. We're in a period right now where among the great multitude of kind and decent people, there's some nuts out there. And I think the president ought to curtail his travel. He ought to curtail his mixing in the kind of crowds. There ought to be a great deal of control. And besides thinking of his own safety, thinking about the peace and tranquility of the country and the danger an assassination would put us through again.
Let's go back to the other side now.
My name is Nils Briska. I come from Albany, New York, but have spent the last 5 years in West Berlin. I have the following question. The impression I have gotten overseas is that the United States has been slipping, or let's say reacting, to to the Eastern Bloc, namely the Soviet Union and China. Now we can go right down the line. I mean, ever since Korea and Cuba and Vietnam and even Helsinki, we haven't initiated any of these. We've been reacting and we've been getting creamed.
Can you get to your question?
The question is, does Mr. Stone believe that the United States has enough problems at home so that we shouldn't worry about problems outside the United States?
The United States is the greatest nation in the world, but it's part of the world. And everything that happens outside affects us, and everything that happens here affects the outside. This is one world. The striking thing about the world today, and a characteristic that increases, is that very few problems today are solvable by any single nation state, no matter how great. You take a simple, non-controversial problem like the preservation of fisheries, the world's fishing resources for the future of mankind, which is linked up with the problem of pollution of the oceans. No one nation can handle it. This terrible inflationary storm that is shaking the whole world is an international problem. The problem of wise allocation, disposal, and marketing of our wonderful grain supplies is a world problem. We can't divorce ourselves from the world.
Thank you. I have a question here for Senator Pearson. Jerry Brown, the governor of California, is one of the most popular politicians in the history of his state, and yet he has no programs, he makes no promises, and according to the members of his own cabinet, he's not even a particularly nice man. How do you account for his popularity? What is it that's so appealing about his leadership?
Well, I think Governor Brown may be ahead of a lot of us. I think he has a real understanding of the depth of frustration. While a lot of people may not agree with what he's saying, it's so refreshing in the manner in which he says it. He's apparently a very candid man. I've never met him. I don't know him, but I have only the news reports. He's apparently a very candid man. He is a man who speaks his mind, and among all of us in the political scene who have a language all our own, he must be a very refreshing man in California particularly.
Yeah. Mr. Stone?
I must say, I too am looking for new leadership and have looked to Governor Brown, but for all his candor and refreshment, I still don't know what's in that head of his, what he stands for.
Thanks. Here, let's go down here to the left.
From Roslyn, New York, and I'd like to ask Mr. Phillips, currently the Senate is considering a bill, S-1, which would reform much of the criminal law code, and you referred to reformation. Many critics concerning S-1 say, for example, it would extend the death penalty to cover more areas than it presently does, and many critics say it would do more harm than good. A, I'd like to know your opinion on S-1, and B, I'd like to see where you see the initiative for reform coming from.
That's a little bit, you know, off the subject. I'd prefer that all of you try to focus on the topic of discussion today. Let's let Mr. Phillips answer it, but try to watch your questions a little bit.
The great bulk of S-1 is a recodification of the criminal statutes as they now exist. And what has drawn the most attention, I believe, is the part that in essence, restates present statutes in terms of national defense in the press, but does make some small changes. There's been a great focus upon this, and I think very little focus upon the rest of it. But I would fundamentally favor the package with some modifications and very, very slight modifications in that press area. I don't purport to be an expert on the criminal statutes vis-a-vis the death penalty and how they're being enlarged, so I can't comment on that. But I think S-1 has had a bad shake in the press because it stepped on the press's toes.
Mr. Stone wants to add something.
I want to comment on S-1 because it does represent a danger to a free press, and it would, I believe, put into effect something that Congress wisely has rejected in two world wars, and that is an Official Secrets Act. The situation we face is that there's an enormous amount of unnecessary classification and unnecessary secrecy. And a government can't operate completely in a goldfish bowl. There has to be a certain amount of secrecy and confidentiality. But when it gets so out of bounds, as it has here, then we have to depend on public servants who are willing to risk their neck to leak out the truth and deal with that problem when it happens. There's no other corrective. And I don't want to see the press hobbled. I don't want to see a thing like a future Pentagon Papers shut off. I don't want public officials in this town who would, in Russia, it's hard as hell to get a telephone book. And I'll be darned if some of our bureaucrats wouldn't classify the telephone book too if they could get away with it.
Let's go down here.
My name is Mark Russell, and I'm from Washington Lee High School. This question is directed to Mr. Phillips and Mr. Stone. If you maintain that the country should be changed, why don't you get out and change it in the proper way by running for public office instead of sitting around and criticizing it? The president should be a man.
Mr. Phillips, have you ever had the urge?
I'll start with that one. I first got active in politics in 1956 as the county chairman of Youth for Eisenhower, and I was in politics really for the following 14 years. And I have found very frankly that such is the power of the press and the media in this age of communications that I have substantially more influence having left politics to become a critic of political inertia. I would not at this point be interested in running for public office, and I think everybody out here ought to dwell long and hard on the power of the media vis-a-vis the politicians, because I think that's another problem in the United States.
Well, you know, it takes all kinds to make a world, and in a free society, it takes all kinds of men, and some people like politics, and some people like to be newspaper men, and everybody's free to do what he's like, what he likes, and make a contribution in his own way. And I prefer being a newspaper man. And I remember when I was running the Weekly, one day somebody, I was out to make a talk, and somebody piped up from the back of the hall and said, "Izzy, what would you do if you were president?" And I said, "I'd resign and start a four-page weekly Washington newsletter."
Now the left side of the aisle.
I'm Thomas Ranicki from Georgetown Prep, and I address my question specifically but not exclusively to Mr. Phillips. Since we all agree that the people have to be involved if we're going to obtain a good national leader, can you explain how, if we already have poor turnout at the national election, can we increase public turnout by having another national election, the national primary?
Well, the national primary, I recommend more to give cohesion to the party selection process vis-a-vis the presidency, and to get rid of this incredible drainage of time and effort. And what Hubert Humphrey referred to in a rather good statement is a turkey shoot in its early stages, where every yo-yo on the Democratic string is running for president, it seems. I think that is something that just dissipates energy and is a waste. In terms of voter turnout, I would favor your automatic registration and a wider spectrum of parties, because in Europe, the combination of the two produces vastly greater turnout than we have here.
Senator Pearson, we have a question for you from the audience here on a card. Congress has delegated many of its powers to the executive. Should these powers be rescinded? Should delegated powers have time limits?
I think so, and I think that was manifested in the action that was taken in the Congress last year and continues over this year, which was the bill which would rescind so many of the national emergencies. I don't know whether many people understand it, but there are about 380 some odd statutes on the books that can be triggered off by the declaration of a national emergency by the president. We're living today under three existing national presidencies, and by and large, that's all been changed by a statute that we've passed, and we hope will be a corrective in that way. I think it's an interesting note that when this country started out, it was on the concept that the initiative of all legislation, programs, and policies would come from the Congress and the enforcement from the presidency. By and large, that's reversed. I don't know of any great initiative the Congress made except the budget. The budget reform committee that we have existing now, and by and large, the power in Washington is the power to know the facts, and only the executive branch today, unfortunately, has had this pyramid of bureaus and administrations and agencies who have this fact collecting data, and that's why, by and large, you have so many of the initiatives coming from the executive. It ought to be reversed. Slowly, there are some trends and light signs in that direction.
Let's go down here to the right.
Mr. Stone.
I'm sorry.
As the one dangerous radical on this program, I don't want to let these attacks on the two-party system go by without challenge. You know, the idea that getting rid of the two-party system would solve our problems, I think, is pretty spurious. There are two problems in government. One is to maintain social stability, and the other is to permit wise change. And it's perfectly true that the two parties are frustrating because they're both conservative and liberal and don't stand for too much. Yet, in my lifetime, I've seen how dangerous a multiple party system can be. While it does provide for many shades of opinion, it creates a terrible instability. And in the case of both Italy and Germany, the rise of fascism was facilitated by multi-party systems, which made it very difficult for governments to act. So while there is a lot of justifiable criticism of this old-fashioned two-party system, there is also a good deal to be said for it. And from the standpoint of effective government, you have to have a pretty large measure of agreement in a great country to make effective legislation and to put it into effect. And the one virtue of the two-party system, and it is a virtue to be thought about and not easily abandoned, is that when the country finally does decide, it does provide effective leadership of a kind you don't get in a multiple-party parliamentary system.
Our next question.
Washington Lee High School in Arlington, Virginia. And I'd like to address this question to Mr. Stone. Mr. Stone, you suggested that we need a leader like FDR, and this is a man who said, and I quote this as my memory best serves me, in his 1932 inaugural address, "If we are to proceed forward, we must move as a trained and loyal army, willing to sacrifice our lives and our property for the discipline of a common good." So my question is, do we need a leader who will strive to plan and control our lives for us with big government, or who will let us freely control our own lives and let us make our own decisions as private citizens?
Well, you know, when a man's been in public life for so many years, you can always get something by picking something. I was for FDR before Chicago, and I didn't like the 1932 campaign one bit. It sounded too much like Herbert Hoover. And I had a lot of criticism, and I wrote it and expressed it very forcefully in a Democratic pro-New Deal paper. And I, too, dislike what you just read. But to think that that sums up all that FDR means is very foolish. Very foolish.
Down here.
My name is Michael Sohegian, and my question is also about what Mr. Stone said about FDR. Are you saying that the policies and philosophies of a politician who was a politician in the 1930s and 40s would work for the world and the United States in the 1970s? And my second question is, don't you think that FDR has been turned into sort of a demigod in these troublesome times?
Did you say demigod or demagogue?
No, he meant sir. What? God. What? He didn't mean a demagogue. He meant a god.
Yeah.
Well, like the ancient Romans, we do have a tendency to deify our emperors. I don't, you know, it's very hard for you kids reading the history books to understand what FDR meant. It wasn't exactly his policies or even what he said, but it was a change of spirit. Herbert Hoover was an extremely able man, and on one great issue, he was really marvelous, on the cause of disarmament. But in the terrible crisis that shook the country after the stock market crash, he just... He just didn't respond. He sort of sat there in the White House like a big lump. And he had no feeling for the farmers that were losing their farms, and the homeowners were losing their homes, and the men who didn't have jobs, and the people selling apples on the street corners. What we got from FDR was a sense of sympathy and compassion and openness and readiness to do something about the terrible crisis, to be aware of human suffering and misery and to try to meet it. And he did help us to meet it. And there was a great interrelationship between the needs and demands of the people of this country and the leadership in the White House, and each helped the other. It wasn't just a case of leadership, it was something very reciprocal. But he created a new spirit, and he attracted to Washington a wonderful bunch of people, of a kind we've never seen in this capital before. A people of very varying philosophies, ranging from a few communists, whose number was greatly exaggerated, to people who really believed in free enterprise. But the one common characteristic of the spirit of the capital for a young reporter wandering around the bureaucracy was the great amount of concern and devotion.
Thank you.
And that's what FDR evoked.
We have a question on a card now. Is it possible that our current malaise stems partly from the fact that we are being governed by a president who was never elected popularly? He has no particular mandate and no authority from the people. Apparently that question is addressed to anyone on the panel. Let's ask Senator Pearson.
I don't think so. I think it's a very significant fact that this is the first time in the history of our nation that we've had not only a president but a vice president who's not been elected by the people. But I think in all of the dialogue in the country and the common denominator of thought about those who like Gerry Ford or those who don't like him or his policies or programs, I don't think that's really a big consideration. People forget quickly. And I don't think that's part of a major part of how they form an opinion about either Mr. Ford as a president or any of his program.
Thank you. Let's go down here now.
Yes, my name is Peter Evanston. I'm a student at Washington Lee High School. My question concerns Mr. Phillips. All three of you were talking basically about big business and interest groups and oil companies and how they seem to have a control on the politicians. Well, Mr. Phillips, you advocated scrapping the public financing that had just come in 1974, and I guess the one in 1972, the previous act. Well, it seems to me that money seems to be the core issue, and that's what the politicians need. And it seems to me that gun control has never been enacted because the NRA has 70 million members and controls a few politicians, excuse me. And I know that...
What's your question?
Well, the question is, how are the politicians going to get the money if we lose the Public Financing Act? And how are we going to stop the interest groups from having any power?
Okay, the response to that, I think, is very simply this, that under the present Campaign Finance Act, you have a built-in preference for the existing structures and for incumbents. It is not a total public financing of elections at all. It's a partial. And what I would move towards is, one, a mechanism which opened it up much more broadly and did not protect and favor incumbents in the existing two parties. And secondly, one which was almost entirely publicly financed in the sense that you have it in most European countries, barring the contributions above a very small limit by individuals or corporations, and in-kind contributions by organized labor, which is a deliberate loophole left by the Democratic Congress so that their allies can wiggle out from under the intention. I would switch much more to almost total public finance.
Let's go down here now.
The establishment of televised debates between candidates for presidential election would bring politicians to the people.
I didn't understand that question. Could you restate it?
Do you think the reestablishment of televised debates between candidates for presidential election would bring politicians to the people?
That's a good question. Yeah. Whom do you want to ask it of?
Mr. Stone.
The question is whether it would be helpful to have televised debates.
I think it would, yes.
We have another question on a card here addressed to Mr. Stone. Do we expect too much from our presidents? Have we been wrong to look instinctively to the White House for all the answers to our problems?
The answer is yes. And nevertheless, we expect a little bit from the president. And you know, in the case of Mr. Ford, at first he was very refreshing, and we all felt very hopeful about him. The first great disappointment was the pardon. And after that, he pretty much went downhill. And he's a very nice man, and I don't mean to be harsh, but really, we haven't had such an inane fellow in the White House in a very long time.
Let's hear from the right microphone now.
Yes, my name is David Levin. I'm a student at Washington Lee High School. My question is, in order to get more ideas in government, I believe it is necessary to get more people in government and have them there for a shorter time than, say, one senator for 13 years.
Are you asking for Senator Pearson's resignation?
That would say offset that, or do you agree that there should be more people instead of just one senator, one politician?
More turnover?
I think that question was addressed to me because he mentioned 13 years and I've been there 14 years. May I respond? This is a issue that continually comes up, and it takes many forms. And that is, should somebody be forced to leave the government when they reach at a certain age, or should they have limitations on the time that they can serve? I think the answer is yes, and I don't know what the time ought to be, and it's got to be balanced against the great wealth of experience that some men bring to public service. But I think fundamentally some limitation of terms, what it ought to be, is a hard judgment, especially for one who's been there 14 years. But those are things that I think would give us fresh ideas. Issues in Congress take the same form year after year. They come in different bills and under different titles, but fundamentally the issues that are coming up year after year are pretty much the same things with different variations, and a new outlook and a fresh appeal might be very helpful.
Thank you. Down here now.
My name is Elizabeth McGrath from Civil Friends, and I'd like to know what Mr. Stone thinks of Mr. Ford walking around the crowds.
What do you think of Mr. Ford walking around in crowds?
Well, I thought I really had said enough about that earlier in the program.
You'll recall that Mr. Stone said he thought the president ought to stay in the White House and tend to his business there. Let's switch to the other side.
All right, I'd like to know, do you think that we need a leadership that is more attuned with 1976 than 1776? It seems as if the generation that basically runs the country now is of the World War II generation, maybe even World War I generation. The people of today, I don't think, the response I get from the youth isn't one of war, it's one of peace. And it seems that the people today, they're leading the country, are always talking about fighting and killing and wars. And
do you really want an answer to the question about the 1776 generation?
Yeah.
Well,
I think...
Mr. Phillips?
Well, I think there's some point in that, in as much as probably the great bulk of the presidential candidates and national leaders at this time do come out of what could be called, certainly the World War II extended the period of American world supremacy generation. And I think they perhaps have a slightly enlarged notion which hasn't been sufficiently deflated at the extent that American power can be applied around the globe. So I think that's partly true. But as for the great new attitudes brought to bear by American youth, I think that's something that American youth and youth all over the world have been saying for however many millennia they have been around about how they're going to change things. And the change, of course, has gone from bow and arrows to napalm, so that they haven't changed it.
Not for the better.
Yes, Senator Pearson.
I want to express agreement with that concept, but I want somebody to explain for me, pardon me, explain to me what happened on the 18-year-old vote. I was one of those that exercised some small role of leadership in getting that through. Thing that wasn't very popular in my state, but when Vietnam and the draft was gone, the registration of the voters just went right down to nothing almost.
What?
Listen.
Well, let's take some people who haven't had a chance yet. Okay. One quick comment for you, okay?
About the 18-year-old vote. When the 18-year-olds did get the vote, Nixon was elected. Nixon was not elected by the 18-year-olds basically because they didn't want to vote for him. The 76, the people that voted for Nixon were your World War generation people, you see, and they were not the youth of today. They didn't have anybody to vote for.
Yeah. Thank you. Let's hear from this side.
Sally Thatcher, McLean, Virginia, and I'd like to direct my question to Senator Pearson. Could you comment, please, on the Federal Elections Commission and what effect, for good or ill, you think it will have on our selection of leaders in 1976?
Yeah, I think that's a good development, and I think it was necessary to have an independent commission. It relates, question relates to the whole subject of campaign finance, and I've been in that for a very long time. I voted for the public financing aspect of it as it exists today, but in the years that have gone by, and as you look at the issues when they come up every 2 years, I think fundamentally all of the complicated election finance reform might be resolved if you have a complete disclosure of where all the money comes from and where it all goes. It may not be anything more complicated than that.
We have time for about one more question. Let's take it from the floor.
So I'm Andrew Gould from Sidwell Friends School in Washington, and I'd like to address this question to Mr. Stone. You said that we need a president like Franklin Roosevelt. Who do you think in the 1976 election would qualify that spot?
You're going to have to declare yourself now.
The honest answer is I don't know.
I think we can squeeze in another. Let's down
here. Humphrey, and I'm from Sidwell Friends, and I'd like to address this question to Mr. Stone. What does he think about the president today? Do you think Mr. Ford would really be a good president? Do you think he can help this country?
No, I think he's hopelessly out of date. He represents an upper class suburban constituency of the kind I grew up in. It's full of very good people, but too distant from the cities and the agony of the cities and the great crises of the time. The job is just way beyond him.
Let's let our other panelists have a crack at that one, too. Mr. Phillips?
Well, I think everybody should bear in mind that Gerald Ford had this job thrust upon him. He's a product of Congress and the congressional leadership, and I think perhaps it might be well to measure him against the Speaker of the House, Mr. Albert, who was also known as the Squeaker of the House, and the Majority Leader of the United States Senate, Mr. Mansfield, who has achieved virtually nothing in the last several years. So that we're talking about a process by which this man came up, and I tend to agree that he hasn't been terribly effective, but neither has the congressional milieu from which he came.
But I wouldn't compare Ford to Senator Mansfield, who's an extraordinarily thoughtful and well-informed man, and from time to time speaks out with a great deal of insight on basic issues.
Senator Pearson, do you want to get into the fight?
Yeah, I want to say something nice about the president, as a matter of fact. I think people ought to be judged in relation to their circumstances and remember what circumstances he came into the presidency. I think we also ought to think about some of the great problems that exist in this country today. We don't really have solutions anymore. We manage problems, just like we do in our daily lives. And I think Mr. Ford has brought a sense of humility and a sense of concern that is very, very needed in this country today. We hear a lot about the imperial presidency. I think his demeanor and his attitude and his sense of trying to compromise, a lot of it's politics coming up for the next 2 years, but a lot of it is a deep conviction on his part that this is the best way to go forward in the country.
That's a good note on which to end. Thank you, panelists, for a lively and informative session. Next week's National Town Meeting will be in the Concert Hall at 10:30 a.m. The topic, whom would you nominate for president? Commenting on your nominations will be Dr. Hunter Thompson of Rolling Stone magazine fame, Pat Buchanan, the former White House speechwriter, and R.W. Apple of the New York Times. The moderator will be the Washington Star political correspondent, Jack German. Thank you.
Thus, the conclusion of this national town meeting, the topic of which was Beyond Personalities, What Kind of Leadership Does America Need? The principal speakers were Senator James Pearson, Republican of Kansas, I.F. Stone, publisher and critic, and Kevin Phillips, author and columnist. From the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, this is Josh Darsa speaking. Technical director for this broadcast has been John Cater. Funds for this program were provided by the Mobile Oil Corporation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.